welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 26th of September 2022, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. It's the beginning of another week, and we have lots of exciting news to get into, plus we have a new Greatest Britain for the week, and as always, I am joined by my co-host, Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, good day, sir. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing very well. Thank you very much. I'm just looking at the progress into the new Carolean era, the era of the reign of King Charles III, and looking to see whether anything much has changed since the end of the Elizabethan era, and it doesn't look as though there's a lot that's changed. Things seem to continue to move in the directions that they were moving before, which is perhaps a little bit disappointing in some respects.
Yeah, I mean, we have a new government, we have a new king, you would expect things to change, but no changes on the horizon just yet. I mean, we do have a mini budget that we will talk about a little bit later on, but one of the things that have been going on, whilst we've also had this funeral, 2 weeks worth of the funeral of Queen Elizabeth II, some other news that has been overlooked is this ethnic strife that's been happening in Leicester. Muslims and Hindus fighting amongst each other. And I did a podcast about this last week, and I tied it back to the partition of India. And once the British left, there were 2 million people killed, 100,000 women were raped. And this trouble between the Hindus and the Muslims, it goes all the way back to then, and probably before, actually, with the behaviour of the Muslims on the subcontinent there. But perhaps you'd like to give your thoughts on it, Max, and tie in what's most recently been happening there.
Well, really, I think the thing for us to focus on here is that just as you and I have been saying for a number of years now, and as other nationalists have been saying over many years, multicultural and multiracial societies are dysfunctional, and this has been exemplified by violence that's recently been taking place in the city of Leicester. Leicester is, I think, the 11th largest city in the UK, and it is also, I believe, the first city to be majority minority, in that the people of white British descent, the indigenous British, are the minority now in Leicester, and there are so many minority ethnic groups there. But the as I say, we've been saying for some time now that multicultural societies are always dysfunctional, and I think that sometimes when we say that, what other people who perhaps disagree with us think is that what we're trying to do is to sort of excuse the fact that there are tensions that could be viewed as having been exacerbated by the things that we say about multicultural societies. But the fact of the matter is that here in Leicester, what we've got now is a situation where for several nights on the trot, there has been widespread violence between groups. Gangs of measured in their hundreds, where there are Hindu gangs and Muslim gangs that have been attacking each other because of intercommunal rivalries. And as we've said, when societies are forced to live cheek by jowl in multicultural societies, there always occurs competition between them for finite resources. That always then leads to ethnic frictions, and that then inevitably, after sufficient time has passed, it inevitably leads to intercommunal violence. And this is what we're seeing, that there was this violence in Leicester was first of all blamed on a cricket match, because India apparently beat Pakistan in the Asian Cup cricket competition that was held in Dubai earlier on this year. And I think there was widespread celebrations by various Indian groups who then took it upon themselves to march up and down the street in various places in Leicester, singing their sort of celebrating, and this led to when they were confronted by Muslims who lived in the areas where they were marching up and down, this led to chants which can only really be described as incitements to racial hatred, where one of the chants that apparently was heard and that's been reported in the news is that that Hindu groups were chanting Pakistan Murdabad, which apparently means death to Pakistan. And apparently they have also been overheard shouting out Jai Shri Ram, which means victory to Lord Rama, which was apparently a slogan that was very widely used during the time of partition, when there was the widespread bloodletting in on the Indian subcontinent. And what's happened is that Muslim groups have retaliated, and apparently there was an incident where a Muslim group pulled down and stole a flag that was flying outside a Hindu temple. And all this has tended to be exacerbated to a great extent as well by reports that have appeared in social media, claiming that, you know, various things have happened which enrages one side and against the other. And so this intercommunal violence has persisted. It turns out that the BJP party, the Bharatiya Janata Party, which is the dominant political party in India, is viewed by Muslims as being an extreme right wing and racist organisation, and there are within the larger Hindu communities here in the UK, there are people who are devout supporters of the BJP, some of them, and the BJP also has a kind of a youth organisation which is called the National Volunteer Organisation, which has got a very long, difficult to pronounce name, so I won't refer to that, but its shorthand for it is RSS, and apparently there are members of RSS organisations already in the UK in those towns and cities where there are large Hindu populations. And apparently there was also an incident fairly recently where a speaker representing, I think it was the RSS or the BJP, was due to speak in Leicester, not Leicester, in Birmingham, and various Muslim groups then objected to that, and there was then disturbances that took place in Birmingham as well, and that led to the visit by this activist being cancelled. But this is the sort of thing that has been going on and off over many, many years. Very often this kind of intercommunal violence between Muslims and Hindus tends to take place when there is friction between India and Pakistan. And ever since the partition of India back in 1947, there have been occasions where India has gone to war with Pakistan over disputes. Quite why they regard all these tiny little sort of parcels of land, because quite often the disputes are just over a very narrow, very insignificant looking little piece of land, but it gets their passions aroused. And I think there have been three occasions, 1947, 1965 and 1971, where there has actually been all-out war between India and Pakistan over territories in Kashmir. And of course, when that happens, what then tends to happen, because the Asian communities that have grown up here in the UK still tend to look to their country of ethnic origin as the country that they feel most passionately for. And so what we have in this country is not only the kind of inter-ethnic rivalries that all the sort of antisocial rivalries, antisocial violences that one might expect to occur in a a monoracial society, in addition to any of those things that might occur, the sort of thing I'm thinking of there is that there could be violence at football matches or something like that. In addition to that, though, because of the fact that for several decades now, successive governments have been pursuing this policy of trying to convert Britain into a multicultural, multiracial society, what that then means is that all of the enmities between various ethnic groups from all over the world are repeated here in the UK, and so you know, we have much higher levels of intercommunal violence than would exist in other countries, and it's something really which can only get worse.
Yeah, the MP there, Claudia Webb, she's had a go at the so-called far right, saying that the far right are stirring this up, and I think maybe that was in reference to the BJP, Modi's party. In India, they've actually spoken out about this and said that this violence is all on the part of the Muslims, and they've been terrorizing the Hindus. And I must admit, the only videos that I've seen, the only threatening videos that I have seen, have been by Muslim rabble rousers. There's one guy with a beard, and I think he's in Birmingham, and he's referring to the Hindus, saying, "Don't you pretend to be gangsters, we'll smash you," and all this sort of stuff. And then there was another Muslim firebrand cleric, I guess you could call him, activist, and he was surrounded by other Muslims, some of them with balaclavas on and hoods up and masks, so you couldn't actually see who they were. And he was ridiculing the Hindu faith, ridiculing their ideas about reincarnation, saying he would rather be a grasshopper than be one of these Hindus. And if they want to have a fight, come up there and have a fight. And of course, this trouble is now spread, that we've seen trouble in Bradford, in Birmingham. And there are literally hundreds of Muslims that have been travelling up to Leicester in order to have a big ruckus, basically. With the Indians that are up there. And of course, it makes you think, well, you know, we try to say people are better off with, you know, with their own people, within their own community. But when you get that, you end up with like sort of ghettos, don't you, where that community isn't large enough. I mean, for instance, if you have the community of Indians that are in India, they've got the whole country there, and they don't have these problems. But when you have a small community of Indians like there is in Leicester, which is living alongside a small community of Muslims, then you get get this problem. Because I've advocated before for saying that, you know, the best thing to do is to have separate communities, homogenous communities. But if they're only small communities, then, and they're living alongside one another, we still get these problems like this. I mean, we see the same thing happening over in Sweden as well, where what they did in Sweden, they put all the Muslims together in one city. The city then became a no-go zone, like Malmö. And I think that's another of these problems that we see are occurring here. I mean, this has been continuing all week. As you said there, Max, they've been pulling down the flags from outside the Hindu temples. There was a car that was rammed over a load of a brick wall, I think, in Bradford, where the Indians were living there. And it's all been highlighted on Twitter. And I think Nigel Farage made a very good comment about it. He said that the people that are to blame for this are the current Conservative government, the Conservative government before that, and the Labour government before that. And he made reference to, I think it was Jack Straw's quote, where he said, "We want to rub the right's nose in diversity." And they went looking around the world to get as many different types of people to come to Britain as possible. And that's what the Blair government did. They opened up the borders, and then the Cameron government came in and they continued with the open borders. And then we had Boris Johnson, who gave out, I think, 1 million visas last year to various different peoples. And of course, those visas don't just go to individuals. They go to whole families as well, to come in. He gave out all these visas to the Hong Kongese, opened up the borders to the Afghans, put all the people that came in illegally across the channel, putting them up in hotels. And this is the result of that. You import these inter-ethnic rivalries that go on the other side of the world. And when there's enough of those types of people within your country, then there's enough of them for these rivalries to take place again. And I mean, we see some horrific crimes that take place in India, horrific, barbaric crimes that take place. And, you know, I'm fearful that we could see the same thing sort of happening here between the Hindus and the Muslims. I mean, when you look at the size of these groups, and then you look at the police that are trying to hold them back, you know, you just think, where are we headed here? Where are we headed? And I think Nigel Farage is absolutely correct to lay the blame for this all on the heads of the politicians and their immigration policy. It's not like they didn't know the problems that India has with Pakistan. I mean, the minute we left India and handed it over to the Indians for self-rule, the country was split in half. Pakistan and Bangladesh were created as new countries. And there was just this huge millions of people moved from India to Pakistan, and millions of people moved from Pakistan to India. And as that was going on, 2 million people were slaughtered between them, and 100,000 women were raped. And since then, there's been these problems. I think these problems really go back to when the Muslims first went into India. I mean, they literally go back centuries. And then we've got Leicester, where you've got Indians and Muslims living alongside one another. They produced a video, apparently, the community leaders, and they talked about how that when they got in there, that they fought together against the racists. And I guess basically what they're doing there is accusing the northerners that actually lived in Leicester before them, who weren't very happy about being replaced. They're calling them racists, and then they're claiming that they actually built Leicester and they made it what it is, as if Leicester hadn't actually existed since Roman times and was actually built by white people. And that seems to be just about all that the police are doing. They're trying to get these community leaders to put a stop to this, and the community leaders appear to just be blaming right-wing elements. And I guess by that they're implying that white people are stirring it up by talking about it, when of course we only talk about it because we want to see the policies changed, the government policies changed that actually led to this. And I think they're also referring to Modi's party, the BJP, who are the Nationalist Party of India. Any comments you want to make on that, Max?
Well, just that you know, there are large parts of Leicester that are entirely Asian inhabited, basically. It's quite remarkable if you go to Leicester to see how much immigrant groups moving into Leicester have come to dominate the city, basically. And as I've said, that because there is this inevitability that multiracialism and multiculturalism is going to spark rivalry between different ethnic minority groups. This kind of violence is something which is going to continue into the future and possibly get worse. You know, we've already seen that it's you know, virtually every time there is a general election in India, for example, there is inter-ethnic violence between Hindus and Muslims, that there is regular conflict between both India and Pakistan over small parcels of land in Kashmir, as I said. And so, you know, sadly, I think this is something which is probably going to continue until governments change their policy and decide that they're going to unravel the multicultural societies that they've been trying to create, and so there can be lasting peace.
Well, we would hope that would happen. We also had some rather interesting news, and I think this is actually quite good news. I mean, it's not good news for the people that are affected, and that's Toby Young's Free Speech Union, who have been deplatformed by PayPal. But because they were such a big organisation and it was Toby Young, the politicians have actually taken notice of this now, and they're actually talking about PayPal debanking groups because of their politics. I've got an article here about it. MPs have hit back at PayPal after it cancelled the account of a parents group which fought hard to keep schools open during COVID just days after doing the same to the Free Speech Union. At Business Questions, Conservative MP for Devizes, Danny Kruger, asked, Does she share my deep concern, and that's Penny Mordaunt, does she share my deep concern about the decision of PayPal, the online payments company, to cancel the accounts of certain organisations, including Us for Them, who campaigned against the COVID lockdowns, and perhaps most ironically, the Free Speech Union, who appear to have been targeted because of their views on sex and gender? Mr. Kruger added that as society is moving towards a cashless economy, financial technology firms will form part of the essential infrastructure of ordinary life. He added, will the government take steps to ensure they cannot discriminate against individuals or organisations on the basis of perfectly legal political views? Commons leader Penny Mordaunt replied, he may have further information than I do about why PayPal have cancelled the account and that facility from the organisations that he mentions. But from what I understand, the Free Speech Union and other organisations are also still in the dark about exactly why they have had those services removed from them, despite making great efforts to find out. Ms. Mordaunt described the unexplained withdrawal of services by companies as a common theme amongst our casework for many MPs. Arabella Skinner, director of Us for Them, told Mail Online the group was really shocked to receive the email from PayPal, and given that it has taken the same penal action against a number of prominent non-profit advocacy, campaigning and journalistic groups in the UK, it gives the distinct impression that this was a politically motivated coup against campaigning groups who had taken a particular view on controversial topics, she said. Reasoned two-sided debate is essential to a functioning democracy, and there should be no room for censorship by way of denial of services. But Ms. Skinner revealed the group were heartened to see MPs speaking up about the issue. We are, however, heartened to see MPs rallying to the cause, and we hope that this brings to the fore the question of whether there is an urgent need to bring in heightening safeguards to protect against economic sanctions against companies operating perfectly legally. And I mean, it's good that this is finally being talked about. And I think Penny Mordaunt said that there should be a debate about this. I mean, the Free Speech Union is basically a union for people that like to have political discussions, like to talk about, like to criticize certain government policies. And this union is there for if organizations try to deplatform them. And of course, this is exactly what has happened to that union. They've been deplatformed by PayPal. And because PayPal pretty much have a monopoly online, I mean, they're bigger than all the other payment processors put together online. If you get deplatformed by PayPal, then that's your business that's essentially been tanked. And this is clearly just politically motivated, because this organization, they help out anybody that has problems with free speech. It's not like they were a right-wing organization or a far-right organization. They're simply a free speech union. And also the Daily Skeptic was deplatformed, and that is Toby Young's skeptical news zine, which was skeptical of mainly the COVID lockdowns and the vaccines and all that sort of thing. So, you know, and this has really been going on for years now. I mean, Mark Collette has been debanked 4 or 5 times. I can recall lots of bloggers 5 or 6 years ago were just getting deplatformed by PayPal. As soon as anybody put in that somebody could send them donations by PayPal, they would lose the PayPal account. And now it's made its way all the way up to Toby Young and the Free Speech Union, and it's finally being talked about in government. And one of the most important things about this is, with this great reset that they're trying to put in place now, which is the reason for all these financial problems and inflation and to do with the debt. We actually talked about this on the Thursday edition of the Daily Nationalist. The plan is to have a cryptocurrency, a central bank controlling everything with an electric currency, and all the money just comes from this one central bank. And if these banks are allowed to deplatform people because of their political views, if they've done away with cash and they do that, then people are going to be in serious trouble. So this is one of the reasons why this is being talked about here. And the MPs, or some of them, have pointed out that the government's own online safety bill, which they're talking about doing, ends up giving too much power to these organizations. And it's only it's not very much difference between whether it's Twitter or Facebook or whether it's PayPal. It's still an online company. And if they're allowed to just de-platform the people that are making use of their service because they don't like their politics, then you're going to see people that are really in a lot of trouble. I mean, it goes against some of the most fundamental values that we actually have, is that you should be able to make business transactions. And people have been pointing out, well, if the bakers have to bake the cakes, then surely PayPal have to process the transactions of people regardless of their politics. So hopefully we will see a debate about this taking place in Parliament at some point soon. Max, any views on banks, debanking activists, and or the Free Speech Union?
Well, to some extent, this was started some time back, where governments I can remember David Cameron making a speech about anti-extremism, where he kind of hinted that the police should be given wider powers to tackle extremists that were just treading the right side of the law. I think that was the impression that was given there, that there was a threat to society by extremist groups that don't actually break the law, but and just steer just on the right side of the dividing line, and that the way to reduce extremism in the country was to give the police wider powers so that they could disrupt the lives and the activities of extremists who were not actually doing anything illegal. And I think this was at the time when Theresa May was also the Home Secretary. And this same trend has been pursued by successive governments ever since. And the danger of this is that one person's extremist is another person's sensible commentator, basically, because it all depends upon your point of view as to whether you feel that somebody's an extremist or not. It all depends upon your point of view as to whether or not you think that somebody's extremist views are dangerous. Personally, freedom of speech is something which you either have or you don't have. It's not something that can be limited. And if you have freedom of speech in a country, then people should be allowed to speak their mind. At the moment, you start to say, well, we can have freedom of speech for all these people, but this group over here, that this group is so extreme, we can't let them have freedom of speech. Then you don't have freedom of speech in that country any longer. The moment you start to limit somebody's freedom of speech, and it's not just PayPal. The banks have been doing this for a number of years. But the first time that I encountered this was probably around about 2007, 2008, something of that sort, when I believe it was one of the major high street banks decided to deny the British National Party their banking facilities, and there was a scrabble within the British National Party to find a bank that would offer them banking facilities. And of course, once one bank decides to deny a political organisation banking facilities, then it then creates a kind of a problem, because it massively affects the credit score that the organisation has, which then means that it makes it much harder. Even if they apply to another bank that isn't politically motivated, it makes it much harder for an organisation to get a bank account with another bank. And in view of the fact that banks, together with other large organisations, have all been over the years browbeaten by this sort of cancel culture, which again is something that governments have actually created. They didn't really intend to create cancel culture, I don't think, but cancel culture is what has emerged, where as I say, certain ideas are regarded as being beyond the pale, and therefore people who hold certain ideas aren't allowed to be members of, and it started off with with the police or the armed services, or you couldn't be you couldn't work for the National Health Service if you held certain views. It then became the responsibility for all organisations that deal with government departments and want to win contracts from the government, that they have to have positive anti-racist policies, and every government department has to have a positive anti-racist policy. And it's not just an anti-racist policy, it's now an anti-sexual preference policy. So anybody who expresses any views that are critical of any one ethnic group, or anybody who expresses views that are critical of any particular sexual group, or any group who, any religious group or anything of that sort, then effectively becomes unemployable, because they're then informed that because they've expressed a view which is anti-woke, that they therefore it's gross misconduct, and so they then get sacked. And of course, once you've been sacked for gross misconduct, it's very hard for you to get another job, even if you apply for a job with an organisation that isn't politically motivated. And so this cancel culture has been created by successive governments seeking to limit the freedom of expression of groups that they regard as extremist, but it's extremism means different things to different people. One man's freedom fighter is another man's terrorist. One man's plain speaking pundit is another man's extremist, and we live in dangerous times, really. And as you say, we move towards a situation where we have a cashless society. It means that those organisations that perform the service of banking, that are transfer money from account to account, from person to person, those organisations will then have a totalitarian hold over the whole of society, and nobody that holds a view that is anti-woke will be able to have a bank account. They won't be able to have a job, because most employers nowadays want you to have a bank account so they can just electronically transfer your salary into your bank account at the end of the month. They don't want to have the bother of printing out a pay slip and putting your money together with the pay slip in an envelope and giving it to you at the end of the week. They want to just be able to have it all done automatically. And so if you don't have a bank account, then quite often you can't get a job in certain areas. And so, it is a very dangerous situation. I personally would hate to see a situation where there is no cash used in society, a cashless society. I would hate to see that, because that in itself would be a big step towards totalitarianism and the denial of freedom of speech and the denial of freedom of action by people. And what we're seeing here with organisations like PayPal is a totalitarianism, because the companies like PayPal feel under pressure from governments to inhibit and disrupt the lives of people that governments describe as extremist. And so they therefore impose deny services to people who they then identify as the extremists that the government is critical of. And we then have a situation where there is no freedom of speech. And of course, if there is no freedom of speech, there's a saying, isn't there, that if you can't have a peaceful revolution, then the only form of revolution that can be had is a violent revolution. And of course, it would be horrible if society was to deteriorate to that sort of a point. But that's the path that we're travelling on at the moment, and hopefully governments will see sense and will introduce civil rights so that companies can't deny people who are behaving perfectly legally facilities.
Well, they need to be treated as public utilities, don't they? I mean, that's the thing. The banks need to be treated as public utilities, and they need to be prevented from just debanking somebody simply because they don't like their politics. I think the word you were looking for there was non-violent extremists. That's what David Cameron came up with to describe people who didn't like his policies, who were acting within the law, non-violently. He said, well, they're still extremists, so they're non-violent extremists, which is this new category. It's very similar to what they're trying to do with the online harms bill, where they have this terminology, legal but harmful. So somebody who is staying completely within the law in what they're saying, but they're criticising the government's policy and the government doesn't like that, so they claim that it's harmful. So they have this new category, legal but harmful, and we also have non-violent extremists. And the result of that, as you point out there, Max, is that people end up being debanked. So it is good that this is now being brought up in the Houses of Parliament, and hopefully there will be some form of a debate about it, and hopefully they will put something into law that banks are not able to just withdraw funds from somebody unless they've actually broken a law, unless they can have been shown to have broken a law. Because all these people that are getting debanked, none of them have broken any laws. And it's just it just hasn't actually been highlighted by the mainstream media yet. And now, finally, it has.
That people can do in order to prevent, inhibit the spread of this sort of thing, is to regularly go out and withdraw cash from a cash machine. If you withdraw cash from a cash machine, then banks are more likely to keep that cash machine open. And if you withdraw cash and you go and you spend cash, then you are preventing the creation, or you're at least doing what you can to prevent the creation of a cashless society. And that's something that everybody can do and that everybody should do just as a discipline. It's since lockdown, we've all found that it's remarkably easy to just go around with your piece of plastic. And it is remarkably easy to go around and pay for everything with your piece of plastic, until the day comes when a bank turns around and has closed down your debit account, or has closed down your credit card, in which case your piece of plastic becomes completely useless, and you are in a parlous situation and that's the sort of thing that we've got to prevent from happening. We've got to create a situation where there is sufficient spending of cash so that a cash-based society can is safe, I suppose, really, from being declared redundant.
Yeah, I mean, people should use cash as much as they can. That is the only way that we're going to be able to keep it alive. Well, shall we move on to our Greatest Britons for this week then, Max?
Yes, that's a good idea. That's a good idea.
Let's start with a new Greatest Briton. Our Greatest Briton for this week is Owain Glyndwr, the Welsh hero. Owain Glyndwr, commonly known as Owen Glyndwr or Glyndwr, anglicised as Owen Glyndwr, was a Welsh leader who led a long-running war of independence with the aim of ending English rule in Wales during the late Middle Ages. He formed the first Welsh Parliament, and he was the last native-born Welshman to hold the title the Prince of Wales, and that was a title that was given to him by the Welsh. I don't think that was acknowledged by the English monarchy. Owain Glyndwr was a descendant of the Princes of Powys through his father, Gruffydd Fechan II, hereditary Tuathog of Powys, Fadog, and Lord of Glyndyfrdwy. Through his mother, Ellen Firk Thomas ap Llywelyn, he was a descendant of the Princes of Deheubarth, and that's Pembrokeshire. And through her, Glyndwr was also a descendant of Llywelyn the Great of the Gwynedd Royal House of Aberfraw. On 16th of September 1400, Owain Glyndwr instigated a 15-year Welsh revolt against the rule of King Henry IV of England. With the use of guerrilla tactics, the Welsh troops managed to inflict a series of defeats on the English forces and captured key castles across Wales, rapidly gaining control of most of the country. News of the rebellion's success spread internationally across Europe, and Glyndŵr began to receive naval support from Scotland and Brittany. He also received the support of King Charles VI of France, who agreed to send French troops and supplies to aid the rebellion. In 1403, a Welsh army, including a French contingent, assimilated into forces mainly from Morgannwg and the Rhondda Valleys region, commanded by Owain Glyndŵr, his senior general, Rhys Gethin, and Cadogan, Lord of Glen Rhondda, defeated a large English invasion force, reputedly led by King Henry IV himself, at the Battle of Stalling Down in Glamorgan, South Wales. By 1404, no less than four royal military expeditions into Wales had been repelled, and Owain solidified his control of the nation. He was officially crowned the Prince of Wales and held a parliament at Machynlleth, where he outlined his national programme for an independent Wales, which included plans such as building two national universities, one in the south and one in the north, and I think that has now been done, reintroducing the traditional Welsh laws of Hywel Da, and those are the laws that actually went back to before Saxon times, and establishing an independent Welsh church, which again is very interesting because that goes back to before Saxon times. This is before the Reformation, before the Church of England. There were envoys from other countries, including from France, Scotland, and the Kingdom of Leon in Spain. In the summer of 1405, four representatives from every cumhwt in Wales were sent to Harlech, and in the same year, he signed the tripartite indenture. So everything was all going really well for the independence of Wales. But later that year, in September, King Henry IV led a large English army of 40,000 men, including heavy artillery, into Wales. Severely outnumbered, Glyndŵr decided to avoid a pitched battle and instead resorted to guerrilla warfare. Similar to the early years of the war, he organised the Welsh army into many small units of lightly equipped and highly mobile warbands, which gave them the ability to outmanoeuvre, surround and constantly harass the English by carrying out ambushes, sabotage, raids and surprise hit-and-run attacks from multiple different locations. The Welsh also raided the English supply lines and successfully captured 40 supply wagons carrying food and water. King Henry's army quickly became demoralised and were forced to retreat back to England, marking yet another impressive victory for Glyndŵr. Despite the initial success of the revolution, however, in 1407, the superior numbers, resources and wealth that England had at its disposal eventually began to turn the tide of the war, and the much larger and better equipped English forces gradually began to overwhelm the Welsh, and by 1409 they had reconquered most of Wales. Glyndŵr fought on until he was cornered and under siege at Harlech Castle, but he managed to escape capture by disguising himself as an elderly man, sneaking out of the castle and slipping past the English military blockade in the darkness of the night. Owain retreated to the Welsh wilderness with a band of loyal supporters, where he refused to surrender and continued the war with guerrilla tactics, such as by launching sporadic raids and ambushes throughout Wales and the English borderlands. The last documented sighting of him was in 1412, when he ambushed the king's men in Brecon and captured and ransomed a leading supporter of King Henry's. He twice ignored offers of a pardon from the new king, Henry V of England, and despite the large rewards offered for his capture, Glyndŵr was never betrayed to the English. His death was recorded by a former follower in the year 1415 at the age of approximately 56. With his death, Owain acquired a mythical status along with Cadwallader and Arthur as a folk hero awaiting the call to return and liberate his people, Imab Darogan, or the foretold son. And Glyndŵr is spelt in the work as Owen Glyndower, appears as a king in William Shakespeare's play Henry IV, Part 1. And I think this really shows that he must have had support from the English, because William Shakespeare actually portrayed him as a king in the play that he made of Henry IV, and we can see that he had support from the Scots, he had support from Brittany, he had support from France, he had support from the continent, and this was a very credible push for independence by the Welsh, and he is really held up today as a great hero of the Welsh people, and he's included in the Greatest Britons, obviously, because the Welsh were the original were the original Britons. He's fairly high up in the BBC's top 100 greatest Britons as well. And he's a nationalist hero because that was what he was trying to do. He was trying to gain independence for the ethnic nation of the Welsh. And Max, do you want to pick up on any of those points?
Well, I don't know a lot about Owen Glendower. I know there's a statue to him in Llanberis, which I've driven past on many occasions on my various visits to the north of Wales. For him to have persisted in resisting English rule over Wales for so long that he died at the age of 56, that's quite remarkable, really. In view of the fact that the average life expectancy, I would have imagined, for most men in those times would have perhaps been 45 or something like that because of disease or whatever. You know, for him, leading a life of effectively warfare most of the time, that is doubly remarkable then that he lived for what probably was a decade beyond the average life expectancy for men of his time.
Yeah, and he managed to unite the Welsh and get them to all fight on his side as well. And it had been about 200 years since King Edward I had actually taken the crown from the Welsh and placed it on his son's head, which is why you have the Prince of Wales today is always the eldest son of the English monarch. Yet Glyndŵr could trace his royalty back to the earlier royalty of the country that could trace their royalty back to Brutus, again, who we've talked about in an earlier episode of The Greatest Britons. And that was Glyndŵr's right to rule. And that's why he was crowned by the Welsh people. And that was why people flocked to his standard, basically. Well, let's start with a look at his early life. Glyndŵr was born around 1359 to a prosperous landed family, part of the Anglo-Welsh gentry of the Northern Welsh Marches, which is the border between England and Wales. This group moved easily between Welsh and English societies and languages, occupying important offices for the Marcher Lords while maintaining their position as Ulchilure, nobles descended from the pre-conquest Welsh royal dynasties in traditional Welsh society. And the Marcher Lords were the people that controlled the borders, basically. And because he was descended from the nobles, he would, and those people that were descended from the nobles that went back to royalty before Saxon and Norman times, they were the ones that held this high position in society, working with these Marcher Lords, who were mainly of Norman extraction. His father, Gruffydd Fechan II, hereditary Tuasog of Powysfaddog and Lord of Glendyffrydwy, died sometime before 1370, leaving Glyndŵr's mother, Ellen Firth Thomas of Llewellyn of Dyhubarth, a widow, and Owain, a young man of 16 years at the most. So he lost his father at a young age. The young Owain ap Gruffydd was possibly fostered at the home of David Hanmer, a rising lawyer, shortly to be a justice of the King's Bench, or at the home of Richard Fitzalan, the third Earl of Arundel. So he's obviously having a lot to do with the English there, with the Earl of Arundel, and also a lawyer that worked for the King's Bench. Owain is then thought to have been sent to London to study law at the Inns of Court. He probably studied as a legal apprentice in London for a period of 7 years, and he was possibly in London during the Peasants' Revolt of 1381. By 1384, he was living in Wales and married to Margaret Hanmer, although they may have married at an earlier date in the late 1370s, according to sources. They started a large family, and Owain established himself as the squire of Sycharth and Glendyffrydwy. Glyndŵr entered the English king's military service in 1384 when he undertook garrison duty under the renowned Welshman Sir Gregory Sias, or Sir Degary Sias, on the English-Scottish border at Berwick-upon-Tweed. His surname Sias, meaning Englishman in Welsh, refers to his ability to speak English, which was not common in Wales at the time. In August 1385, he served King Richard II under the command of John of Gaunt, again in Scotland. In 1386, he was called to give evidence at the High Court of Chivalry, the Scrope v. Grosvenor trial at Chester on the 3rd of September that year. And the High Court of Chivalry dealt with issues of heraldry. Apparently it's still there, but it doesn't actually get used for very much now. In March 1387, Owain was in southeast England as a squire to Richard FitzAlan, the fourth Earl of Arundel, in the English Channel at the defeat of a Franco-Spanish-Flemish fleet off the coast of Kent. So he's seen a fair bit of live action actually defending the English. Upon the death in late 1387 of his father-in-law, Sir David Hanmer, knighted earlier that same year by Richard II, Glyndwr returned to Wales as executor of his estate. Glyndwr served as a squire to Henry Bolingbroke, later Henry IV of England, son of John of Gaunt, at the short, sharp Battle of Radcot Bridge in December 1387. So he actually served as squire to Henry IV, who was his opponent later on when they started the revolution. From the year 1384 until 1388, he had been active in military service and had gained 3 full years of military experience in different theatres and had seen at first hand some key events and noteworthy people. King Richard was distracted by a growing conflict with the Lords Appellant from this time onwards. Glyndwr's opportunities were further limited by the death of Sir Gregory Sayce in 1390 and the sidelining of Richard FitzAlan, the Earl of Arundel, and he probably returned to his stable Welsh estates, living there quietly for 10 years during his 40s. The bard Iolo Goch, or Red Iolo, himself a Welsh lord, visited Glyndwr in Sycharth in the 1390s and wrote a number of odes to Owain, praising Owain's liberality and the writing of Sycharth. Rare was it there to see a latch or a lock, is what he said. And there are still parts of Great Britain today where people don't lock their doors, but what he was saying here is that they didn't even have latches or locks on their houses. They had such a community of trust there. So he's seen a lot of military activity, and he's now, what does it say here, in his 40s. So when he actually led the Welsh, I mean, he was getting on there, Max. As you were pointing out, to die at a late age like that, he must have been very healthy at the time. Got any comments you want to make on his early life?
Yeah, it's also fairly clear that he was somebody of note within English society as well as Welsh society. You know, he had friends and sponsors, people that he worked with, people that he worked for, that were senior people of substance within British society generally, not just in Wales. So he wasn't somebody who was a nobody who just decided to launch a revolution for spurious reasons. He was somebody who had been an actionary. He was somebody who was active within English society and was given responsibility and higher responsibility than lots of people would have had during their lives during his early life.
Yeah, he'd shown loyalty to the king. He'd shown loyalty to England. He'd fought for them. And I think, you know, the uprising or the revolution, I mean, it did stand some chance of success. I mean, it wasn't 200 years since the crown had been taken by England. 150 years is just the length of time. So I think he did think that there could have been some measure of success with this. In the late 1390s, a series of events began to push Owain towards rebellion in what was later to be called the Welsh Revolt, or the Glyndwr Rising, or within Wales, the Last War of Independence. His neighbour, Baron Grey de Ruthyn, had seized control of some land, for which Glyndwr appealed to the English Parliament. Owain's petition for redress was ignored. Later in 1400, Lord Grey informed Glyndwr too late of a royal command to levy feudal troops for Scottish border service, thus enabling him to call the Welshman a traitor in London court circles. Lord Grey had stature in the royal court of King Henry IV, and the English courts refused to hear, or the case was delayed because of Lord Grey, preventing Owain's letter from reaching the king. So we see that this neighbour, who was one of these marcher lords, he stole some of Glyndŵr's land there. And when he was supposed to tell Glyndŵr that he needed to get his men together to support the English king, he didn't tell him. And then he was denouncing him as a traitor. However, an alternative source states that Glyndŵr was under threat because he had written an angry letter to Lord Grey, boasting that lands had come into his possession and he had stolen some of Lord Grey's horses. And believing Lord Grey had threatened to burn and slay within his lands, he threatened retaliation in the same manner. I think I believe the first one more than this second one. Lord Grey then denied making the initial threat to burn and slay and replied that he would take the incriminating letter to Henry IV's council and that Glyndŵr would hang for the admission of theft and treason contained within the letter. The deposed king, Richard II, had support in Wales, and in January 1400, serious civil disorder broke out in the English border city of Chester after the public execution of an officer of Richard II. So it seems like we had two kings there at the time, two English kings. One of them had been deposed in favour of Henry IV, and there was support for Richard II in Wales. These events led to Glyndŵr formally assuming his ancestral title of the Prince of Powys on the 16th of September 1400 at his Glenfrothwy estate. With a small band of followers, which included his eldest son, his brothers-in-law, and the Bishop of St. Asaph in the town of Corwen, possibly in the church of SS Mael and Sullium, he launched an assault on Lord Grey's territories. After a number of initial confrontations between King Henry IV and Owain's followers in September and October 1400, the revolt, which is a prequel to the War of the Roses, began to spread. Much of northern and central Wales went over to Glyndŵr. Henry IV appointed Henry Percy, the famous Hotspur, to bring the country to order. The King and the English Parliament on 10th of March 1401 issued an amnesty which applied to all rebels with the exception of Owain and his cousins, Rhys of Tudor and Gwilym of Tudor, the sons of Tudor ap Gronwy, the forefather of King Henry VI of England. Both the Tudors were pardoned after their capture of Edward I's great castle at Conwy on the 28th of May 1401. In June, Glyndŵr scored his first major victory in the field of Menyth Hedyn on Plumlimon. Retaliation by Henry IV on the Strata Florida Abbey followed in October. The rebel uprising had occupied all of North Wales. Labourers seized whatever weapons they could. Farmers sold their cattle to buy arms. Secret meetings were held everywhere, and the bards wandered about as messengers of sedition. Castles fell into Glyndŵr's hands as he assumed the Prince of Wales title. Henry IV of England heard of a Welsh uprising at Leicester. Henry's army then wandered North Wales to Anglesey and drove out the Franciscan friars who favoured Richard II. All the while, Glyndŵr, who was in hiding, had his estate forfeited to John Beaufort, the first Earl of Somerset. Glyndŵr had been offered a pardon on the 10th of March 1401, but he rejected the plea. On the 30th of May, Hotspur, having won a battle near Cader Idris, left his command for the English army and began dealings with Glyndŵr. During this time, in spring 1401, Glyndŵr appears in South Wales, and by autumn the counties Gwynedd, Ceredigion, which temporarily submitted to England for a pardon, and Powys adhered to the rising against the English rule. Glyndŵr's attempts at stoking rebellion with help from the Scottish and the Irish were quashed, with the English showing no mercy and hanging some messengers. So he wasn't able to get Scottish and Irish support here. But we can see that his ancestry and his cousins go back to the Tudors as well. And when the Tudor kings actually came in onto the throne of England, their ancestry did go back to Brutus, and they went back to the Welsh ancestry. So it was actually seen by the Welsh that they actually had their own kings on the throne again with the Tudors. And as it says here, this is a precursor to the Wars of the Roses. Do you know anything about the Wars of the Roses, Max? Do you know anything about this period in history?
Not a tremendous amount. What I would say is that from listening to what you've been saying about Owen Glyndŵr, there seem to be lots of rivalries between various families that have got noble heritage, basically, and so the staging of a rebellion by Owen Glyndwr against English rule isn't so much an act of politics on his or sort of ideology on his part, more an act of rivalry where he felt that he would make a better king than the King of England, and so therefore and because of his familial attachment to Wales, used Wales as the instrument of his rebellion and rivalry against the King of England at the time. And so I think that the danger of looking too deeply and regarding these kind of things as being of too great a significance is that you run the risk of reopening old wounds effectively. And I think that we have to be careful in this situation in terms of viewing somebody like Owen Glyndwr and to make sure that that our perception of him is as somebody who is demonstrating leadership ability rather than somebody who is demonstrating some kind of ideological position which is better than that was presented by the King of England effectively.
Yeah, I don't think it was so much ideology. It was his ancestral right, and I think he would have been loyal to the King of England if they had acknowledged him as being the Prince of Wales. I don't think there was any idea of his to go to war against the English. They just wanted independence for Wales. They wanted to have their own universities, and they wanted to follow the laws that they had always followed, which were by that time they were called the laws of Huelda. But they actually went back to before Alfred the Great, and going all the way back to the Brutus line, the Molmutine laws. That was the original guy that created these laws, and that was all that they wanted to do. And you know, he had standing in England, and he had served the king, and he had served militarily, and he understood the legal side of things. So he was basically just trying to exercise the right of Wales to actually be independent, because they'd had enough of bad treatment from these Marcher lords. And I mean, you had that Marcher lord there that was playing dirty tricks on him. He would have found the men to go and fight in Scotland for the King of England, but the Marcher lord didn't actually give him the letter. So that shows you that he did have this this loyalty. It's not like he would have tried to take over England and take over the whole country or anything like that. He just wanted Wales.
What I'm saying there is that those kind of dirty tricks probably were the sort of things that were practiced between families of noble heritage descendants from kings of old all over the British Isles. So you probably would have had noble people from Norfolk. They would have felt rivalry with noble people from Suffolk, and people from Norfolk would have had rivalry with people from East Midlands or something of that sort. And so and they would have played the same kind of tricks on each other as they jostled for influence, and as they jostled for in the hope of claiming the throne of England, as well as holding a dominant position in their regional part of the British Isles.
Oh, definitely. There were all sorts of dirty tricks that were played against one another. And one of the impressive things is that the Welsh were all offered pardons if they would stop supporting him, but they didn't stop supporting him. You know, they wanted to be independent, and they wanted to follow their own prince. Well, in 1402, the English Parliament issued the penal laws against Wales, designed to establish English dominance in Wales, but these actually pushed many Welshmen into the rebellion. In the same year, Glyndwr captured his arch-enemy, Baron Grey de Ruthyn. He held him for almost a year until he received a substantial ransom from Henry. In June 1402, Glyndwr defeated an English force led by Sir Edmund Mortimer near Pileth, which is the Battle of Bronglas, where Mortimer was captured. Glendower offered to release Mortimer for a large ransom, but in sharp contrast to his attitude to de Grey, Henry IV refused to pay. Mortimer's nephew could be said to have had a greater claim to the English throne than Henry himself, so his speedy release was not an option. In response, Mortimer negotiated an alliance with Glendower and married one of Glendower's daughters. It is also in 1402 that mention of the French and Bretons helping Owain was first heard. The French were certainly hoping to use Wales, as they had used Scotland, as a base from which to fight the English. Glendower, facing years on the run, finally lost his estate in the spring of 1403, when Prince Henry, as usual, marched into Wales unopposed and burnt down his houses at Sycharth and Glendyffrydwy, as well as the Comote of Iduronion and parts of Powys. Glendower continued to besiege towns and burn down castles in response. For 10 days in July that year, he toured south and southeast Wales until all of the south joined arms in rebelling against English rule. These actions induced an internal rebellion to the King of England, with the Percies joining the rising. It is around this stage of Glendower's life that Hywel Sul, a cousin of the Welsh prince, attempted to assassinate Glendower at the Nanow estate. So we see that a lot of the English are taking part in this as well. Relatives of this royalty that also had a claim on the throne. So it wasn't just the Welsh that were involved here. In 1403, the revolt became truly national in Wales. Royal officials reported that Welsh students at Oxford University and Cambridge University were leaving their studies to join Glendower, and also that Welsh labourers and craftsmen were abandoning their employers in England and returning to Wales. Owain could also draw on Welsh troops seasoned by the English campaigns in France and Scotland, and hundreds of Welsh archers and experienced men-at-arms left the English service to join the rebellion. In 1404, Glendower's forces took Aberystwyth Castle and Harlech Castle, then continued to ravage the south by burning Cardiff Castle. And then a court was held at Harlech, and Gruffydd Young was appointed as the Welsh Chancellor. There had been communications to Louis I, the Duke of Orleans in Paris, to try and gain a treaty, but they failed in opening the Welsh ports to French trade. So they've even got so far as trying to sort out trade agreements with these other countries as well. And you've now got all the Welsh in England that are joining the cause, as well as the supporters of people that had a different claim on who was supposed to be the king at the time. Max, any thoughts on that?
Well, just that it's remarkable actually how similar what was taking place in England or Britain at the time mirrors similar developments today in between Russia and Ukraine.
And what were they using a proxy?
Well, not necessarily using it. Where external powers are using a proxy, but where, for example, Ukraine has succeeded in having good relations with other countries and incorporating help from them in securing their independence from Russia, and where Russia effectively is kind of like playing the position that England played relative to Wales, and with various alliances coming into play and various people giving help to either one side or the other.
Yeah, there's a lot of historical precedents here that are similar to what's going on over there. Also, you had the Welsh were prevented from speaking their own language, and also in Ukraine, they prevented the Russians from speaking their own language. So there are all sorts of historical precedents that took place between England and Wales that we do see happening right now with Ukraine and Russia. And these points here that the French were seeking to get a treaty with the Welsh so that they could then use the Welsh as a form of attacking the English, which again is, well, I would say, suggest is similar to America working with Ukraine and then using the Ukraine as a proxy to weaken Russia and to go against Russia. So you see, all these things have historical precedents, and it helps to understand them so we can see what's going on today. But I think we should probably leave that here for now, Max. So I'll say thank you very much for coming on today.
Thank you for having me on.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next week with another Real Britannia for you. And of course, we do hope that you have a great week ahead of you.